Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 352, recorded Friday, June 22nd, 2018. Phil Zimmerman. Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a huge role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and talk about what they've been up to and what they think. And I am thrilled to welcome Phil Zimmerman, who is an Internet Hall of Fame member, creator of Pretty Good Privacy, PGP. He teaches crypto now at Delft University in the Netherlands. That's where he's located. But he's also still very much a privacy advocate and very much in the forefront of privacy. And Phil, I haven't spoken to you since the screensavers back in...
That's right. Yeah, Leo, I think both of us had considerably less gray hair at that time.
I'm thrilled you remember it. Actually, there's video of it on your page, which is fantastic.
That's right. That was 15 years ago.
Yeah, at least. Yeah, it was a long time ago. So things have changed. We've come an interesting distance in the last 15 years. First of all, let's go back a little bit to PGP and its creation, because I think there's... I still use PGP in the form of GNU Privacy Guard. It's an open PGP implementation. PGP is open source, and still, I mean, when Edward Snowden wanted to communicate with, I guess it was Glenn Greenwald, he said, install PGP. And, of course, Glenn said, what's that? How do I do it? And never could figure it out. But for those of us who have, and I don't think it's that hard these days to use it, it still is. It remains.
Yeah. When I heard that story, I felt like Snowden should have just found another journalist who, you know.
yeah, maybe that was the right
PGP,
answer.
Yeah.
You don't know that, huh? Well, he worked with him somehow and managed. In fact, we have friends, people like Dan Patterson, who have made an effort to go to areas where journalists and activists are at great risk and teach them how to use technologies like Signal and OpenPGP that they can have these private communications in countries where your privacy is absolutely not protected in any way. So for all of us who still use PGP and those of us who've used it over the years, and for Edward Snowden, thank you, Phil, for that really important work. You're no longer connected with PGP, are you?
No. Well, PGP is in the hands of its fifth owner. First, it was me in 1991 through the mid-90s. And then starting in 96, it belonged to PGP Inc., a company that I started. And then a couple of years later, it was sold to Network Associates.
Oh yeah, I remember them.
And then they had it for a couple of years, they didn't really know how to sell it. They sold hundreds of products, and their salespeople didn't invest a lot to learn what it was. So they another startup formed called PGP Corporation, not related to PGP Inc., and they bought the assets from Network Associates. So now. Then it was another company that specialized in this product. And that went on for a few years, and they turned that into a successful company and then sold it to Symantec for, I think it was like $350 million.
Oh, Phil, I hope you got a big chunk of that.
No. I had a big chunk of PGP, Inc., in the 90s, but... You know, as it changed hands each time, it's like it's not my company anymore. Yeah. You know, it's not my product. It's not my company. So I did have a tiny amount of stock in that. And And since then, Symantec has, they even changed the name. They don't even call it PGP anymore.
Really?
And I think they have it maintained in India or something like that. Yeah. So
are you okay though with what really happened to PGP, which is the open PGP
Course. Yeah.
That's
so there's a number of vendors that implement the same protocol.
Right.
GNU Privacy Guard is one of the better known ones. There's also some web-based ones. There's Hushmail, ProtonMail, StartMail, maybe one or two others.
You've consulted with some of them, I think, yes?
Back in around 2000, I did some work with Hushmail. They were the first one to do it on a web-based approach.
I used Hushmail.
People
now really seem to like ProtonMail. I'm still old school.
These days I'm working with a company here in the Netherlands called StartPage. They have a product called, it was called StartMail, but I think they're changing it to StartPage Mail. And they're working on a new generation of that product, and I'm helping them with that.
Can you, I'm old school. I use GNU Privacy Guard. I install it. I download the keys. I generate keys on a local system. I do share the key publicly with a open source company called Keybase, keybase.io.
Yeah.
And they use, actually, that's interesting how they use PGP because they use it also, for a lot of other things, including a secure Git, secure folders.
Yeah. They're using it in creative ways.
Yeah. They now do chat messaging secured by PGP, and they have exploding messages, which I really like, with perfect forward secrecy. So they're doing some really interesting stuff. But I have to commend you because PGP was really the first publicly available, relatively easily installed open version of public key crypto. You made it possible for everybody to use public key crypto, and you've got to feel pretty good, regardless of the financial, remunerations. You've got to feel pretty good about the legacy that you've left.
Back in 1991, it was not really feasible for anyone to communicate securely. Nation states could because they can afford to hire somebody to carry keys in a briefcase on an airplane to some foreign embassy their embassy in a foreign country and distribute keys that way. But ordinary people could not. And PGP made it possible for the first time for ordinary people to communicate over long distances without their stuff being intercepted.
And it's evolved well. I mean, it's there are people now using elliptic curve crypto with PGP. There have been recently two fairly significant flaws in the open PGP implementation, both of which have been corrected. But it is stood the test of time, I would say. I used 4,096 bit keys just to keep up with modern computing. That's changed a little bit, but it still works.
That's right. Yeah. The threat model was very different back then. At that time, you attach your computer to the internet only once in a while. You would dial in to pick up your email from a mail server with a modem. And then after you've downloaded your mail and uploaded your mail, you hang up the call, and now your computer is once again isolated, where it spends 99% of its time isolated. The world has changed so much. Now we're online all the time. At that time, there was not so much of a threat of someone reaching in from remotely, reaching into your desktop computer and exfiltrating your PGP keys. I did allow for the possibility that your PGP keys could be stolen. I encrypted them with a passphrase as the key, but that threat just didn't seem to be a very likely scenario. Today, your keys are sitting on your laptop for years at a time, and anytime during that period, somebody could inject malware into your computer through maybe you're opening a PDF file or visiting a website that attacks through your web browser, and then they inject malware into your computer. The malware escalates its privileges to, you know, be able to access anything they want, and they can exfiltrate your keys. And so protecting your PGP keys today is a lot harder than it was 25 years ago. If you want a more secure execution environment, you're better off with a smartphone, because the sandboxing that protects applications from each other and protects, you know, let's say you had a secure communications product like Signal or Silent Phone or WhatsApp.
WhatsApp is not as secure as one might have thought. You just ask Paul Manafort,
right,
who's in jail right now, because he trusted WhatsApp.
Right.
So stick with Signal, I think.
You have to be really careful. It is hard to write secure communication software. You have to think of everything. If you decrypt the messages and display them on the display, then they're sitting in memory in plain text form,
right,
and they're also stored, you know, in the longer term storage of that application. And if that gets backed up to a server somewhere, then they can see your messages. So you have to be careful. You have to think of everything, and it's expensive to develop products that are so careful.
It seems to me, since we talked in 2003, at the time, it seemed such an innocent time.
At
the time, we were concerned about privacy. I think now, 15 years later, maybe it's even more important than ever, and maybe more.
The internet has become vastly more hostile than it was 15 years ago.
Vastly. And governments are not more hostile than they used to be, but they've...
I think back then, spam was just getting started.
Yeah.
And, it was a minor annoyance. But now, you know, you have nation states with thousands of engineers that go to work every day focused on the single-minded purpose that they went to the university to study and learn to do and focus their entire professional lives on breaking into your computer and exfiltrating all kinds of things and injecting malware to take over the computer. That's something that we didn't see 15 years ago.
Yeah. If you
now,
were to write PGP today, if you were to start over, what would you do differently?
Well, I would do some things differently. I mean, I would have to take into account the current threat models. The design decisions I made at that time were optimized for the threat model that existed at that time. And so today I would do something to protect the private keys more. It's hard to protect them. Anywhere you put them, it's hard to protect them.
Yeah.
If you put them on your laptop anywhere, they could be exfiltrated. Your keystrokes can be intercepted, and so they could find out what your passphrase is. You could try using some external hardware, or you could try using a hardware secure enclave. You know, Apple has something like that in their iPhone. In fact, you're seeing some of that in the Android world as well.
Not as well as
Apple has developed.
Yeah.
The ARM processor has this thing called the Trust Zone, and some vendors have developed it to a pretty sophisticated level. Apple has carried it further than the Android world, because the Android world is balkanized into like 100 different companies making smartphones. And so you don't have that same devotion of engineering resources to advance it to with the state that Apple did.
But you need
hardware assistance to do a good job protecting keys these days.
Okay.
You can't just do it all with software. One of the things that I'm helping StartPage do, you know, they have an encrypted email product that's server-based. Right now it's called StartMail, but their they're making a next generation product, which will be Start Page Mail. And that is going to try to leverage a hardware secure enclave on the server that Intel makes. It's called SGX. And combining that with a lot of things that are going on in the browser. But if you just did it all in the browser, it's not a very safe environment. The browsers have a large attack surface. In fact, your whole laptop has a large attack surface, but browsers as an application have quite a large attack surface. And you don't want to just do it all on the server either, because then you have to trust the server a lot. But I think that if you're going to do a web-based approach, you do have to trust the server to some extent, because even if you do it on the browser, then the JavaScript that's downloaded to your browser and executes is also supplied by the server. So it's a pretty complicated situation to protect your private keys. And you need hardware assistance to do that. So that's what I'm trying to work on, is sort of a hybrid approach involving the server and the client in the browser, and also a hardware secure enclave on the server.
How about protocols?
Triple DES, Blowfish, and RSA in the early days?
I never used Blowfish.
You never used Blowfish,
No, I have used Triple DES. And then later I used Twofish. Twofish is a good cipher. And AES. AES is, Twofish was part of the AES competition. And AES was the winner of the AES competition in the late 90s was a Belgian cipher called Rheindahl. And so those are all very strong ciphers. And then there's hash algorithms, hash functions. It turns out it's much harder than we thought to make good hash functions.
There have been lots of rainbow table attacks and things like that.
It's not just rainbow table attacks. Back many years ago, we found that you could find two messages that hash to the same hash. And so this resulted in NIST creating another competition called the Secure Hash Algorithm SHA-3 competition, and they had to find a new strong hash algorithm, which they did. And so hashes have improved because of that.
How are hashes used in PGP?
Well, we use them mostly for digital signatures. But we also use them for reducing the passphrase that you type. You type in your passphrase, and it reduces that into a key to be used to decrypt either decrypting messages or decrypting your private key, which you then use to decrypt messages. But hash algorithms can be used for signatures also.
Right. I'm sure anybody who is watching
hash algorithms are used for a lot of things. They're incredibly versatile.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, if you forced me to design a crypto system where I wasn't even allowed to use a block cipher, I could probably get the job done using just a hash algorithm.
Just with hashes. Interesting.
Yeah.
And you'd use SHA-3?
Well, yeah, maybe so. I mean, I still use SHA-2 or SHA-256 a lot because of legacy burdens.
It's been deprecated, not because it's been cracked, but just because the presumption is computing power is going to continue to increase to the point where it will be vulnerable.
I don't think that anybody thinks that we're going to exhaust.
Really?
We're not going to break SHA-256 or SHA-512 by some exhaustive calculation, but we should be using SHA-3, and we do. And some of the candidates that were part of the SHA-3 competition, but the big storm brewing on the horizon that everybody is worried about in the crypto world is quantum computers.
Yes.
In some years in the future, maybe a decade from now, there will be computers that are quantum computers which are magically fast.
Magic is a good word here, because there's a little bit of a leap from current technology to a working.
That's right. They are crazily capable. if we ever build them.
Yeah.
You know, some years ago, I didn't think we were ever going to build quantum computers. I didn't really take them seriously, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. Then NIST and NSA both issued warnings that we'd all better get ready for quantum computers. And if NSA tells you to get ready for quantum computers, then you better take that seriously. Because, you know, it's the NSA's job is to secretly build quantum computers
right.
and break all of our communications, right? You know, so if they tell you that, hey, you better batten down the hatches and get ready for quantum computers, then, oh, my God, you better do that.
This is one of the things that always has made me, I found darkly humorous about the NSA, is that they really have two missions. One is to spy on us. And the other is to protect us from being spied upon by everybody but the NSA.
Well, that's right. The NSA has the part of the NSA that has the bigger budget is the part that spies on us.
Right.
And you know, they do, you know, they intercept vast amounts of communication, and they have incredible cryptanalytic capabilities and lots of computing resources and lots of mathematicians and engineers and scientists working hard on being able to break things. But there's also a part of NSA called the Information Assurance Directorate, whose job it is to protect American communications for government, diplomatic, military use, and also the civilian sector. And the IAD, the Information Assurance Directorate, they're more like what you might find in private industry, you know,
right.
Companies that build products to protect things. And I've worked with the IAD. That they're the ones that supervise the advanced encryption standard. They supervise it to the extent that they sent a representative who stood by with his hands in his pockets while all the cryptographers from all these different countries competed with each other in a demolition derby.
I think he probably had some recording devices as well.
Well, I know who he was. He was Brian Snow, who's an old friend of mine. He's been retired for many years. But Brian told me that his job was to just make sure they didn't pick anything stupid, which was a risk because some of the submissions were, in fact, stupid.
Right.
But it wasn't that much of a risk because all these very competent cryptographers who submitted their own smart designs were engaging in a very cutthroat demolition derby. So that has a very Darwinian effect. And so the stupid ones die fast.
Good.
But anyway, you know, just a few, and, you know, before Brian retired many years ago, he said that he wished that the Information Assurance Directorate could break off from the rest of the NSA so that it would have report up a different command because he felt that they could be more independent.
They're somewhat conflicting missions.
Yeah, yeah. And so what happened is that just a few months ago, the IAD was absorbed back into the NSA's, the rest of the NSA.
Oh.
So now you don't have a separate IAD. It wasn't separate to begin with, but it was kind of self-contained inside of NSA.
Right.
But now it's been absorbed. So I don't think that was going in the direction that Brian was hoping for.
Yeah. So back to quantum computing. So the NSA considers it a legitimate threat. That means we should be aware of it. Why is this an issue?
Well, it's an issue because it breaks public key cryptography, especially.
They're fast enough to brute force the prime refactoring that
all the modern, you know, public key crypto systems that we have deployed all over the internet today, where you do all your online banking and e-commerce and, you know, PGP or all the other crypto utilities that we use day to day on the internet. They're all based on public key algorithms that are based on a couple of different math problems that are kind of related. One is discrete logarithms and the other is factoring. And in fact, discrete logarithms and factoring are kind of related in that if you could factor fast, you can also compute discrete logarithms fast.
Hmm.
So Diffie-Hellman and elliptic curves are based on discrete logarithms. The discrete log problem, and RSA is based on the factoring problem.
Right.
So if quantum computers can break either of those two math problems, which it can if you could actually build a real quantum computer, then then it will be able to cut through those algorithms like a hot knife through butter.
We should point out, it's not that current computers can't. It's that they take a very, very long time to do it.
Yeah. It takes brute force longer than the age of the universe to do it with other computers.
It's kind of an issue. But quantum computing is potentially so much faster that it could do it in a matter of human scale days or weeks or...
No, more like seconds or minutes.
Seconds.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and I thought we were a little bit safer with ECC, with elliptic
curve. Well, you know, there are a lot of benefits to quantum computers. They'll be able to solve a lot of important math problems for us. They'll be able to do simulations.
We might get real weather forecasts.
They can do chemistry simulations and weather and find new pharmaceuticals and simulate what happens inside of living cells and things like that. And so there's a lot of benefits. We'll be able to, you know, cure diseases, find important new drugs and stuff like that. So the benefits to humanity will be manifold. However, there is one profession in the world that is sweating bullets over it, and that's cryptographers.
Is there nothing on the horizon that... I mean, it was a big deal when public key crypto was discovered, was invented. It was a huge deal.
Yeah, there is what we have to do. Is you see, all of public key cryptography is based on math problems that are easy to calculate in one direction, but very difficult to calculate in the opposite direction.
Right.
And I mean, for example, if you take two large prime numbers and multiply them together, you can do that really, really fast. But if you want to take the composite number that's the product of the two primes and factor it back into the two primes again, that takes the age of the universe to do it if these are very big primes, which we use very big primes, you know, to do crypto that we want to deploy in the real world. And the same is true for these other, like Diffie-Hellman with their, it's a different math problem. But what we need to do is to find some new math problems that are not so easy to break by quantum computers. And there are some, and we found several important new math problems that are easy to calculate in one direction but hard to calculate in the reverse direction. Even if you have a quantum computer, you still can't do it fast in the opposite direction.
And
that's what everybody's working on now. So there's some based on lattices, some based on coding theory, some based on something called isogenies. And so there's a whole bunch of candidate algorithms that NIST is now and has a new project running. It's a competition just like we saw with the AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, and the SHA-3 competition. Now they're having a competition about algorithms for the post-quantum era. You know, the era of quantum computers, the era where your opponent has a quantum computer. You know, you have to develop public key algorithms that are strong enough to withstand an attack from an adversary that's equipped with a quantum computer. And that isn't here yet. We do have the algorithms that we think we can make work there, but the quantum computers aren't here yet. They're maybe a decade away. But that future time, you know, the post-quantum era, we call these algorithms post-quantum cryptography. We can run the algorithms now on a normal computer. It's not that you don't need a quantum computer to run these algorithms. The idea is to have public key algorithms that you can run on your smartphone or your laptop or your server or whatever it is, and that they can encrypt things in a way that quantum computers can't break. And that's what everybody's working on now. Not everybody, but, you know, a lot of people. And so I'm kind of evaluating those algorithms to put them into protocols like OpenPGP.
That's exciting.
Or lots of other things, too.
That's exciting.
And I'm a little bit handicapped because the math is so much harder. I mean, I understand the math of RSA and I understand the math of Diffie-Hellman, but I do not... Maybe I have to struggle a bit with elliptic curves, but, you know, I can get it if I keep plugging away at it. But I've tried reading some of the papers for these post-quantum algorithms, and boy, is it hard. I find that I just can't keep up with the math.
Phil, if it's hard for you, I give up.
But, you know, my favorite quote from Clint Eastwood is, he said, a man's got to know his limitations.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's how I feel when I'm trying to read these academic papers describing how these post-quantum algorithms work. But even if I don't, if I can't keep up with the math, I can take these algorithms and plug them into protocols effectively. And you have to choose carefully to find the right combinations of things to update these widely used protocols that we've all been using for many years, and just replace the classic public key algorithms with new ones that are able to stand quantum computers.
We're talking to Phil Zimmerman, who teaches this stuff at Delft University. He's also an Internet Hall of Famer, the creator of Pretty Good Privacy, which is the most widely used email encryption software in the world. And he's done a lot to protect our privacy. We're going to have more with Phil in just a bit. I want to talk to you about today, about what we're doing today and how we can do this better. And I'm really interested in the idea. It's sort of the holy grail of incorporating privacy into our day-to-day email without the hassle of installing, which personally, I don't think is a big hassle. I've had a PGP key since I interviewed you in 2003. But I'm the only, I send out all my mail is signed, and I maybe once a month I get an email from somebody saying, just seeing if my PGP implementation is working. And I'll say, yes, it is. And I have maybe 400 or 500 keys in my chain. But do we ever exchange encrypted email? No, because it's hard. So how can we make
this? It is.
How can we make this better and easier?
One of the difficulties is that you don't have a PGP client that runs on, your smartphone.
Yes,
I carry a smartphone around.
Yeah,
I also use the iPad tablet, and I use Mac OS. I'm kind of an Apple guy. And although I can run something similar to PGP on my Mac OS, I can run GNU Privacy Guard. I cannot run it on my iPhone or my iPad.
Right.
It just doesn't work for
that
platform.
I can do S/MIME signing in the Apple Mail, but not PGP.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. I want to spend some time with this. So we need to take an ad break. I'll give you a chance to take a break too. Phil, it's so great to talk to you again. And we're all very, very grateful for the work you've done in privacy. I also want to talk to you about this whole notion that law enforcement in this country has of going dark, because you've talked a lot about this as well. But we'll get to that in just a second. Our show today brought to you by our sponsors, Rocket Mortgage. If you are ready to buy a home loan, it's funny. I ran into this morning at the gym, I ran into my loan guy from the last loan. You've heard me tell this horror story. When Lisa and I bought our house in 2013, how it took months, literally more than a month, I think 2 months, to get a loan. And they kept coming back. And I said, Dave, how you doing? You remember those days? He said, I never work with them again. That was the worst loan I have ever written. I said, well, what do you think of Quicken Loans? He said, oh, they're the best. Quicken Loans, they are the best. The number one lender in the country in volume, in customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. They're just awesome. And now they've got an online mortgage approval process that doesn't take months or even weeks or days, but minutes. It's called Rocket Mortgage, and it's entirely online. With Rocket Mortgage, you'll apply simply. You'll understand fully. You'll mortgage confidently. You can even do it on your smartphone. Just go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Just go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. If you sign up now, you get started, you'll be ready. It'll take just a few minutes to get the loan. So you go, you look at an open house. You say, let's buy this house. You go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. It's easy because their trusted partners let you share your financial information at the touch of a button, so you don't have to go to the attic and find pay stubs or bank statements is all very straightforward. You choose the term, the rate, the down payment. They crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credit. They'll analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify, and they'll find the one that's right for you. They also do refis. And I asked Dave, I said, are interest rates going up? He said they are, and they're going to go up some more. Now's a very good time to refi. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. Just go to RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. We thank him for making this show possible. Our guest, I'm so pleased. I'm so honored, really, to have him here, is Phil Zimmerman, a guy who has done so much to protect us and our privacy, the creator of PGP, Internet Hall of Fame member. He is truly a legend, and we're really pleased to have him on the show today, talking about privacy, talking about PGP, the future of public key crypto. You're working with Start Mail. There's others like Proton Mail. You worked with Hush Mail in the past. Even Google said, we will someday add encryption to Gmail.
You know, they actually implemented that, but they did not deploy it.
How interesting. So they use HTTPS. They use TLS to, if you're sending Gmail to Gmail.
Everybody uses TLS to connect to the mail server of their choice.
Right. So that's not real crypto. We're talking about a crypto that only you and your recipient can read the message, period.
Yeah. With TLS, anyone who controls the server can read your messages.
Right.
They're stored in your inbox in plain text form, but they're encrypted on their way to the server and back. Yeah. You know.
Hey, that's better than nothing. So this is a challenge. I mean, even Google has had a hard time doing this. But you've attempted this. You've attempted it in the past, and you're trying to do this now with Start Mail. So how is it possible? Because I would love to use I would love to use a client, a web-based client that was secure end-to-end, not just in transit, but everywhere. How do you do that?
What people are mainly doing for end-to-end encryption is that they're using text messaging apps.
Like Signal.
Yeah. Yeah, and I also built one called Silent Phone. You know, for 15 years, I worked in secure VoIP. I mean, everybody knows about my PGP work. Well, not everybody, of course, but the people that like to follow crypto, they know about PGP. But for the past 15 years, I've spent a lot of my time on secure voice over IP.
And by the way, I owe you an apology, because we're making you use Skype.
That's not very secure.
They always said it was secure.
This is an interview that's going to be broadcast, so I don't think the security is that important.
It's not like we're talking to Snowden. Actually, I think sometimes he'll have to use Skype too from time to time. So Skype says it's secure. Why is Skype not secure?
Well,
I don't want you to be in politics, so if it's...
Yeah, where can I begin? Well, you know...
Does Microsoft have access to the conversations? Do they have the keys?
Well, I think they do, but I don't want to... It's not my place to criticize how they do things.
It's not an open protocol either, so...
I've
always thought, now, correct me if I'm wrong, that if crypto's not open, you shouldn't use it.
I've always told people that you should not use a crypto product if they don't publish the source code.
Right.
And I try to influence anyone that I'm working with, when helping them write their own crypto product, I always urge them to publish their source code.
And even a step farther, if you can't compile the source code and run it yourself, because it's one thing for them to publish source code.
Yeah, but who's going to do that, you know?
No, I understand. You know? Only somebody with a really dire need for privacy.
I think that it's not likely that you're going to do that. But on the other hand, you could sleep at night knowing that others could.
Exactly. I'm not going to review the source code and know it's secure. I can't see a backdoor, but the fact that it's published...
Well, when I first published PGP, it was small enough that someone could sit down and review it.
Right.
But over the years, code bloat came along and just it became so huge that it becomes so difficult for someone to take the time and human resources to go through it all.
So rather than saying, who don't you trust, Phil, we'll stipulate that it should be open source. So that you can review the code, or somebody can review the code, make sure there's no back doors. But even if it's open source, we've seen very poorly implemented crypto. So it needs to be widely reviewed by real crypto experts.
Well, that's right. You know, there's things, I mean, look, there. You know, there's a TLS protocol stack called OpenSSL that was used for many years.
It had a big hole in it.
It had, you know, there's been a couple of holes that have come up, and some of them are spectacularly awful.
Yeah,
and that comes from the fact that you know, people just don't invest the time. It takes significant engineering resources to do a code review.
Right.
So
cost a lot of money to get TrueCrypt audited. Do you trust Signal and Moxie Marlin Spike? Is their code clean and good?
Well, I believe that they strongly believe in the right to privacy, and they do publish their source code.
Right,
and so I tend to trust their crypto.
And then, as you mentioned, you did Silent Circle, which that had the black phone, and then has a messaging protocol. You're no longer with them, though.
No, I left more than a year ago.
Okay.
Silent Circle, when I was a co-founder of Silent Circle, and when we first started the company, we made a decision early on that I think was a fatal decision, which was to charge money for every subscriber. It was $10 a month.
Right.
And so that killed the network effect. With $10 a month, we never got more than a tiny number of users. You know, it was maybe 20,000.
Without charging money, you don't have a business.
Well, but what you could do, and what I urged them to do, was to have a free version and to achieve network effect, because network effect is table stakes in this game.
You bet.
You know, have to have network effect. I mean, you don't need network effect for other kinds of products. If you were doing, you know, if you were doing a spreadsheet or a word processor or a game, you know, you don't need network effect unless it was a multiplayer game, you know. But a secure communications product, it's communications. You have to have network effect. So look at how Skype became so successful. They gave it away for free, and then after they had some millions of users, they upsold with selling minutes to make phone calls on normal phone lines. You know, they called it Skype Out, and it was calling out to the public switch telephone network. But you can only make money at that if you have a large population of users to start with. And if you just figure that only a small percentage of them will purchase these PSTN minutes, then, well, if it's a small percentage of, you know, 100 million users, then you'll still make a lot of money. But if you don't get that network effect, you can't do that. You know, that revenue opportunity just isn't there for you. So if you want to make money, you have to give it away free to achieve network effect. And then you can upsell them by selling them minutes, you know, Skype Out or something like that, or maybe business features. There are some features you could put in the product that consumers don't care about that enterprise customers do care about. So you could sell those features. So that would have been a better strategy for us, and we didn't do that. The other fatal mistake that we made was building the black phone. It's capital intensive to build a smartphone or any hardware product. It's a
difficult business.
And, you know, you have to purchase parts for building, you know, 100,000 phones. And if you don't sell 100,000 phones, you're kind of screwed, you know.
But so the lesson of Black Phone was you need to you said earlier, the phone is a good device for this kind of communication.
Oh, yeah. It's, I mean, you know, smartphones are a way of implementing sophisticated encryption software in a portable way that you can walk around and make secure calls anywhere you happen to be.
You based Silent Circle on OTR, right?
No, oh. Not at all.
I thought you did. Okay.
No, we're using something pretty similar to the Signal protocol.
Okay. Do you like OTR? Is that I think the Signal protocol is also based on OTR.
Well, it's not. Oh, no,
okay.
Not at all.
I misunderstood then. Okay.
No, there were other protocols that do encrypted text messages.
Right.
But they were designed in an era where you had desktop computers, right. And they were always plugged in. They always had power. They were always online. They had uninterruptible power supplies. The router had uninterruptible power supplies. Everything was always there, always online. So if you had a protocol that required a couple of round trips to negotiate the cryptographic keys, that was okay because Alice and Bob are both online at the same time.
Right.
And they can do that back and forth to make it happen. But with smartphones, you're walking around with a device that, you know, it's get in an elevator, you're on an airplane, you have it turned off because you don't want it on when you're sleeping or something. And whatever it is, you're just out of coverage. I'm on a train. I'm going between cell towers and you can't maintain the steady connection that you could with a desktop computer. And so these protocols like OTR and other text messaging protocols were designed from an era before smartphones. And what was particularly clever about the Signal protocol was that it solved the problem of what happens when Alice and Bob are not online at the same time. They came up with a way of solving that one single problem.
Right.
And that's why it became successful.
Right.
In fact, Skype, they solved a different problem that made them successful. They solved the problem of network address translation, which is this thing about
NAT traversal.
How do you know the IP address? Yeah. They solved the NAT traversal problem. Right. And the rest of their product was pretty much the same as every other VoIP product. But
reason
the other
we
ones
Skype
didn't solve that problem.
They solved it. Yeah, that's right.
and so sometimes you have some problem that stands in the way of that whole industry. And if somebody can just solve that one little problem, one big problem, then that means their product takes over. And that's what happened with Skype long ago.
Right.
And that's also what happened with Signal. They solved a different problem. This was a problem of how do you make it so that you can do this when Alice and Bob are not online at the same time. They solved that problem and they did it very well and still had forward secrecy and, you know, things like that. So they did a good job in the protocol and so now their protocol is widely used.
Right.
And I used it myself I used something similar to their protocol. We did our own version of it.
Let's talk about StartMail, because there's another problem, the usability problem. Ideally, any privacy solution should be simple for the user to implement. You've got this issue. You don't have to exchange symmetric keys anymore, but you've got this issue of getting the other guy to use it. I guess in a way, the fact that OpenPGP exists is a good start.
That's part of the, you know, it was hard to achieve network effect with PGP because there was a high cognitive burden.
Yes.
From the beginning, from the early 90s, there was a high cognitive burden to using PGP. You had to understand something about trust models. You know, how do you get your keys signed by other people and why do you care about that? Why is that important?
You solve that with a kind of a chain of trust, and people would have key signing parties and I trust you and
right.
you trust this guy. So I can trust this guy and that kind of thing.
If you ever wanted to see a critical mass of geekiness, go to a PGP key signing party. You've never seen anything as geeky as that.
What fun though.
but this is not the kind of thing that your mom is likely to embrace, you know? Yeah. And so if you want to have something that your mom can use, you need something with a lower cognitive burden.
Yes.
And that was PGP's Achilles heel. And I mean, you know, the competing protocol at the time was S-MIME.
Yeah.
But it had a different obstacle. It also had a high cognitive burden of a different sort, in that someone had to create a public key infrastructure. They had to put a certificate authority who signed everybody's keys, and you had to have that installed and implemented, and everybody had to have their own key signed by some organizational key, and that was just too difficult for people. And so even though S-MIME was widely deployed, it was embedded in Microsoft products, no one used it. And so PGP was able to outcompete S-MIME, even though you had to go find PGP somewhere and install it yourself.
Right.
It was easier. You could make it work right out of the box, except for the fact that you had to get keys signed by someone, and you had to also sign other keys maybe. And so it was cognitively complex to use PGP. And S-MIME was just too hard to, you know, it was like a step function of difficulty. And so no one used that. Even though it was widely deployed, it was kind of statically deployed. It was there, but no one turned it on, you know?
There are ways to do... I use S-MIME and Apple Mail because it doesn't support PGP on iOS natively. But there are third-party mail apps. Canary Mail is the one that leaps to mind that support PGP. But none of them have solved this cognitive burden. You still have to create a key and share
the key
and all of that.
So I mean, there has been a lot of discussion about trying to find another way to have keys certified for PGP, involving something similar to a concept called certificate transparency that we've seen come about in recent years. There's a couple of projects that are trying to do this. It involves, I don't know what kind of audience you have for this show.
They're sophisticated.
So it involves Merkle trees, and it involves ways of making sure that when you download your public key from a server, the same, you upload your key to the server, and later you can download it again to see if they're giving everyone the same key. And if they give it to you, you can verify that it's the same key they're giving everyone else.
Oh, that's cool.
So you can check on them.
Yeah.
And that's, but that's not really deployed yet. That's something that is still under development. And so, but if they can make that work, then it could reduce the cognitive burden. You can be reasonably sure that you've got the right public key without having to have a grassroots trust model where everybody has to be sufficiently sophisticated to sign other people's keys. If they do that, that will probably increase the network effect a lot. And with that, then you can finally see the numbers really take off. I think today there's probably only a few million people in the world that use PGP. Compare that with, let's say, WhatsApp, which has also encrypted messages, but they have like 1.5 billion people.
Yeah. Well, and that's the, I guess that's the good news, is that good enough, I guess, would be the phrase I would use. Good enough privacy is now become fairly widespread.
There is a lot to be said for good enough.
Apple's messages is another example. I mean, they use cryptography. It's not trust no one in crypto.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, you need to have really good, really strong crypto for certain kinds of threat models.
Right.
You know, if you're a journalist trying to operate in a war zone, and your communications are intercepted, then it's crucial that you use really strong crypto, that your keys are managed in a very careful way, you know. You know, then you need really good stuff. But if you're, if you're just comparing sending unencrypted mail with sending mail through a TLS tunnel, then it's better to do the TLS tunnel. You know, right. At least you got something there.
Right. So let's, the challenge of a webmail-based crypto system is multifarious. you tried this before with Hushmail, as I mentioned. There's the Swiss-based Proton Mail.
Well, you know, Hushmail had a problem at the beginning. They were downloading Java applets. This was back about 2001, maybe something like that.
Yeah.
And maybe it was in 2000. Anyway, they downloaded a Java applet in your browser. It's kind of like what they do now with JavaScript, you know, except it was Java.
Right.
That was back before everybody stopped using Java. But it would take a long time to download this JavaScript, Java applet. And in 2000, you know, not everybody had broadband.
Right.
So everybody had modems, and it would take a long time to download through the modem this big Java applet.
Was each message a Java applet?
No, but you had to, like, log into the website, and then you had to download this massive Java applet.
Right.
And customers complained about it, and so what they wanted was something much faster. So Hushmail, you know, relented. They, you know, they were kind of purists. They wanted to do it right on the browser, you know, not on the server.
Right.
So they said, okay, well, then for customers that really insist, we'll make a service where we'll do it all on the server, and you just type in your passphrase, and it'll go through SSL.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then people were happier with that.
Sure.
And,
that's good enough.
And then over the years, they stopped supporting the Java applet because nobody cared.
Right.
And so today they just do it all on the server, you know, and, you know, you sort of have to do what the customers demand, I guess. But
how is StartMail doing it?
Well, you know, StartMail is this product that they have right now that's from StartPage, but they're replacing it with a new generation product. And that's the one that I'm helping them with. The one that they have now is all on the server, but the one that they're working on is going to be take a kind of a hybrid approach.
So tell me about that. Tell me how you, because I mean you've been doing this a long time now, 20 years, more than 20 years, 25 years.
Yeah.
So you presumably we've improved, iterated, and we've got better ways of doing this. What's the current state of the art?
I'm waiting for them to get to a certain point in the development of their new generation product, and then they have to do some extra things that I want them to do. But that's, you know, that takes a lot of time. It's a small company, you know. This is not a massive engineering team, so it takes time, and that's kind of what I'm waiting for.
I think, you know, we're still, in other words,
I actually have four jobs right now.
Yeah.
I'm at the Technical University of Delft.
Right.
I also work for KPN, the phone company in the Netherlands, part-time. These are all part-time things. I work also part-time for StartPage. And I also work for a Swiss company. So I actually have four jobs.
Wow.
I don't have time to tie my shoes.
I'm just thrilled.
StartPage is working on this new thing, and we're going to do some things on the server and some things on the client in the browser. And we're also going to do some things in a hardware secure enclave that's on the server. And that hardware secure enclave is going to contain private keys that are out of reach of the rest of the server.
Ah.
Even if you have kernel privileges, you still can't get in.
I like that.
So that mitigates a lot of the vulnerabilities.
Right.
And so that's an interesting approach. The other thing that's happening right now is at the end of this month, this is June of 2018 that we're having this conversation. There's going to be a meeting in Germany organized by BSI. That's a German government agency that protects German communications. It's kind of like the NSA's Information Assurance Directorate, except it's a totally separate agency. And their job is to protect German government communications. And I think German civilian communications also. And they're calling a meeting to try to figure out how to bring PGP up to date, the Open PGP standard up to date. It's a very old protocol, and it needs to be brought up to, you know, handle current threat models. So that'll be an interesting meeting. And I, the guy who wrote GNU Privacy Guard, Werner Koch, he'll be there. And the guys who also did that eFail vulnerability attack that was actually a very clever attack, they're going to be there too. and everybody wants to see some improvements in the protocol. And I'd like to point out this vulnerability that this was about a month ago, I guess, that this came out. It's not a vulnerability in the OpenPGP protocol. It's a vulnerability in the email clients that use it.
It's HTML email. Damn you!
Yeah. It's an email client is a very it has a huge attack surface. In fact, email has a huge attack surface. It's horrible. It's not only encryption that you have to worry about. It's also just like opening attachments. You know, if somebody sends you a PDF file and you open it, you could lose a presidential election. You know?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. If John Podesta had not clicked on that PDF, then, you know.
Boom. Boom.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit. We're going to wrap it up. You know, this morning, right before the interview, the U.S. Supreme Court kind of shocked me by ruling that law enforcement should not have access to cell phone location information without a warrant, without probable cause, eliminating a massive market in cell phone location information, selling it to law enforcement. I'm sure AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile and Sprint are all pissed off. But doing a lot to protect our privacy. We've seen law enforcement, the FBI, complain again and again that they're going dark, that encryption tools like yours have given them less access to criminal activity. But on the other hand, there is a law called Zimmerman's Law that as technology increases, the ability to surveil will increase. Which is it?
Yeah. there is... so much, it's the golden age of surveillance. There's surveillance everywhere. There's cameras on the streets. I mean, you see this in London and also in China, where you have millions of cameras on every street corner, you know, looking at people walking by. And behind those cameras are facial recognition algorithms. And so you can identify everyone walking down the street, everyone, thousands of people walking by, you can identify all of them. And this power increases over time. But it's also traffic cameras that read license plates of cars. You know, if you run a red light, you can get a ticket, which is good that, you know, that, I mean, for that purpose, maybe that's okay. But they're also using it to keep track of where all the cars are going, so that you can just track people everywhere they drive their car. And then, of course, we're embracing self-driving cars, and those are in constant touch with servers that keep track of where you are. And they'll tell you where the next place you could plug in to recharge your batteries. And so what we have is, and plus there's, you know, credit card transactions and airline tickets, and, you know, there's this vast sea of surveillance, and it's fused together into this kind of total information awareness. And this is the golden age of surveillance. And for them to demand that we not have end-to-end encryption, it's kind of like this big display where there's a few black pixels where they can't see it. And I don't want to hand over the last few pixels to them just so they have a completely flawless display where they, you know, where have 100% of the pixels covered. I'd rather hang tenaciously on to these last few pixels. I can't do anything about a lot of the other surveillance they have, but, you know, I think they've got it pretty easy. Well, they're not going dark. Having a few tiny little pixels left for us and our privacy is not going dark.
Phil Zimmerman, God bless you. Thank you so much for the work you've done and are doing. And for preserving those last few pixels. We really appreciate it. PhilZimmerman.com, ZIMMERMANN. It's got
That's
three
right.
M's and two N's. Don't forget it. Phil.
That's right. Two N's.
I don't want it to be another 15 years before we talk. I hope we'll talk again real soon.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Creator
My
of
pleasure.
PGP. I can't imagine somebody more important to today's privacy discussion. And I am very proud to have been a PGP user since I talked to Phil. Not since he started it 27 years ago. That's amazing. That's really amazing.
Yeah, I was younger and thinner then.
Thank you for your time today, Phil. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Take care. We do triangulation. Normally, we do it at 3 p.m. On Fridays. We did this one a little early to accommodate Phil's schedule because it had been the middle of the night in the Netherlands. 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. Yep, 2200 UTC. If you want to stop by and watch live, I hope you will. We'd love to have you. All you have to do is tune in twit.tv/live to watch the live stream. If you do that, join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. But on-demand copies of everything we do, this show too, available at our website, twit.tv. For this show, twit.tv/TRI. Share it with your friends. Let them know, because I think it's important that they hear the message Phil had today. And then go sign up. Go to Keybase or somewhere or download GNU Privacy Guard and install PGP on your computer. Just get your key. Put it on the key servers. Let's all have a key signing party. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.